Hi, today is February 2nd, 2020, and this is MobileViews Podcast 316. I'm Todd Agassi-Ward, my good friend John Westfall. And this week we're going to look back on the iPad decade, which was, the iPad was announced but not released, I think, on January 27th, 2010, or thereabouts. So announcement-wise, it turned 10 next month, but it was released on, I want to say April Fool's Day or somewhere, no, April 4th. Is that right? April 4th. I think that's the...
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. In any case, I got a couple of links in the show notes to refer to. One is what Steven Sinowski, former Microsoft Windows 8 development head, has to say about iPad. As you remember, you know, not Bill Gates, but Steve Ballmer, I think, poo-pooed the iPad.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people that thought the iPad was dumb.
Including a number of my friends who thought I was wacky for kind of drooling and lusting for it after it was announced.
Well, and you can't blame people after how tablet PCs had been in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, we were used to them being slow, clunky, non-optimized. Your finger wasn't as good as a mouse. You needed a stylus, but you might not have had a stylus. Yeah, all of that stuff.
AKA Windows tablet PC.
Yeah, which I have one over here, which hardware-wise, it looks like it should be great.
Yeah.
Operationally, wasn't so great.
And don't forget, it also is as hot as a furnace.
Yeah.
Okay, and I should note before we really get started that I put a widget in between my microphone and John's microphone and our recording tool, because I think our volume was a little soft, and I was increasing it in post-processing in Audacity, but I don't think it quite did the job. So we'll see if this volume booster in between our microphones and the recorder helps any or makes it worse, you know, if we're blowing it out. But we'll see. Okay. Next up, I just wanted to mention, I'll put in the show notes, Wired has a really nice summary of the hardware iPad history. The iPad turns 10, a look back at the first decade, and talks about every year and every model. Very interesting article, you know, to kind of refresh your memory if you don't remember all the details, and including, you know, the introduction of the iPad Mini, which is, you know, still one of my favorite platforms, although it's not nearly as successful as I thought it would be. And the last link I'll provide in the show notes is a Pew Research article called Millennials Stand Out for Their Technology Use, But Older Generations Also Embrace Digital Life. And the thing that I found interesting in that research report is that Pew Research found that Gen X, Millennials, and Baby Boomers are all at the 50% plus tablet ownership level. So... while the younger generation, as you might expect, adopted faster, currently they're about the same. So millennials, 55% of Gen Xers have a tablet, 53% of millennials, and 52% of baby boomers. So not that much difference. Probably statistically significantly different, but for all practical purposes, not different. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, John. John, so did you get the first iPad? In 2010?
I did, and I used it for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
And then I used, my usage kind of tapered off. And then for about, I'd say, 2 months, 3 months, it sat in my closet.
I
didn't really know what to do with it or where it was going to fit in with my life. And then I got once the iPad came out, obviously there were others, and I think I got a Samsung Galaxy Tab, the very, very first
one. I got that one, too.
And it was 7 inches, and it was easy for me to use in bed. And then once I could start seeing some usage scenario where I would have used to drag a laptop around, I could use a tablet.
Right.
Then I started using the original iPad a little more.
Oh, interesting.
But it really wasn't until, I think, the iPad 2 that it was small enough or less, you know, light. It was lighter weight. Because remember, the original iPad was thick.
Yeah, it's huge.
Compared to what we would think of today as an iPad. So it wasn't really until the iPad 2 where I went, okay, this is going to be useful. But yeah, I had the first iPad, but I didn't quite know what to do with it.
It's funny because I bought a Samsung Galaxy Tab 2 because I found the iPad too big to lug around with me all over. Although I did. I did carry it in, I forget what kind of case I had for it, but I bought some kind of like a not a backpack, but like a, you know, man bag that I carried it in. But the iPad, the Galaxy eventually was much easier to carry around. But in any case, I found really three things that really made a difference to me on the iPad. Maybe four. I'm trying to remember. So, you know, looking back in our list in no particular order of the most influential iPad apps versus our, some of which are my favorites, but, you know, not necessarily. The ones that sort of made a difference, in my opinion, in the way people look at tablet technology and the iPad in particular. And it's really the only tablet that succeeded well. First was the Safari iPad for iPad browser, you know, Safari Mobile. Well, not perfect. It was the closest thing to a desktop experience that we had on a mobile device. And I think, John, you and I both remember that we had lots and lots of discussions with Microsoft about their crippled Internet Explorer browser for Windows Mobile. And we kept telling them, you need a better, you know, you need a more desktop-like experience. And they said, no, you don't. And, well, you know.
Well, the Microsoft attitude was, the web will change for us.
That's right.
You know, that's everyone right. will start making mobile-optimized versions of their website, and they won't mind keeping two separate versions of their website, you know, one for mobile and one for desktop. That was, you know, it's weird looking at it today where we've merged into a situation where obviously it makes sense that maybe your UI is responsive enough that it can rescale itself for desktop versus mobile. But at one time, I fully think that even people at Microsoft thought there was no way people would ever browse seriously on a mobile device. You will only browse serious web pages on your computer. You might read headlines, you might read blurbs, but you will not read full articles or full interactive websites.
And they're right, because their Internet Explorer for mobile is such a terrible browser. You know, you just didn't want to use it. At least I didn't. I did use it when I had to, but it was grudgingly, like, I have to see this, you know, and I'm running around, you know. But it didn't work with many things. And Safari Mobile was not perfect either, but it was more perfect, or as we say in Hawaii, mobera. and it got closer to it. And of course, what happened was, because it was close enough, it was heavily used. And as it was heavily used, website developers noticed and started making their websites mobile friendly, or more mobile friendly in some cases. So there was a convergence rather than a forced migration to mobile that Microsoft envisioned, I think, at any rate. And even today, there are some websites that don't run well on a, you know, mobile browser, with exception of Chrome on the Chromebook, because it's a full Chrome browser. But anyway, Safari for iPad. The other one that was, I think, you might be surprised, Netflix to me was like a super important app, because it not only changed the way I looked at videos, I watched videos, it changed the way I thought about subscriptions. And John, I don't know if we had this discussion like 10 or 11, 12 years ago, but I just did not believe in subscription services. It's like, you know what, just let me pay for the darn thing, you know, at a movie or CD or, you know, things we don't buy anymore. And or books, you know, ebooks we still buy. But it changed though. I said, oh, this subscription thing, this is not a bad way to go. You know, I can live with this, you know. And this is, I had already like poo-pooed Microsoft's various attempts at music subscriptions, Zune Pass and all those kind of things. I passed on Zune Pass. So, you know, it sort of softened me up for the world to come. And I resisted Microsoft Office 365 subscription for years. Until I finally got a free year because some lawsuit about OneDrive space. And then after that, I said, I might as well pay for it. It's pretty good. So, yeah, I don't know. Are you a heavy Netflix user, or were you a heavy Netflix user one time?
I still do have Netflix. I pay for Netflix, Hulu, Disney Plus, and I think that's all the streaming services I have right now.
Now, do you
play an Amazon Prime Video, if you want to count that.
Yeah, I do.
And I do put them on my iPad, and I do watch them occasionally on my iPad.
Yeah.
So now, I think the iPad really was the thing that spurned people to using those sorts of services, because nobody wanted to sit at their computer all the time.
Yep. And just out of curiosity, and a side track our seltzer a minute. Is are you buying Hulu and Disney Plus and ESPN together? Or are you buying Hulu and Disney Plus separately?
I am buying Hulu and Disney Plus separately. My Hulu subscription is still the $5.99 tier. And my Disney Plus through D23, I picked up the 3 years of membership that comes out to, I think, $4.50 a month.
Yeah, it's really
or so.
Good deal.
So, yeah, those are the two I have, and I don't have ESPN.
Okay, and yeah, and with that deal, it's far cheaper than the pack, the bundle anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, so that was you know, the life-changing for me in the sense of, now I get subscriptions, kind of, you know. I still wasn't thrilled with it, but I understood where they might have value. The other one that's kind of, you know, semi-related, and I don't know if you agree with me, John, you can strike this from the list if you want, is Flixster. And the reason I say that is, you know, people may not remember, but 10 years ago, if you wanted to know what movie was playing, what was coming up, where was playing, it was hard. I mean, I think Yahoo had some kind of movies list, and it would show what's coming up, but it wasn't very good. And Flixster, you know, of course, it was more powerful on the iPhone, but in a sense, because you're running around with, you know, with connectivity. But Flixster on the iPad was like, wow, I can, you know, browse much easily than I could on my iPhone, and, you know, try to decide what movies I want to go to. And I really do enjoy going to movies more than now, maybe, but. It really changed the way, you know, I had to do this one task. Kind of like weather on the iPhone, right? Getting weather was just a pain.
Yeah.
Prior to the iPhone.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that, because I think some of the things that we... So this is going to sound weird, but when we made certain things easier, we sort of realized that we either liked them or we didn't like them, and the industry changed.
Mm-hmm.
So when we made it easier to get weather and made it easier to get movie times and all those things... No longer could the industry sort of say, we don't need to change. All we need to do is just make it easier for people, because they made it easier and we didn't go running back to the theaters. We didn't go running, you know, we didn't tune back into the Weather Channel at all times. You know, the Weather Channel mobile app did not drive people to watch more of the Weather Channel.
That's a good point.
It drove people to say, okay, that's all I needed. And the Weather Channel had to evolve and movies had to evolve. And that's why we've seen things... You know, MoviePass and stuff like that over the last 10 years, where they've tried in some ways to change versus the same old thing. So we forget that at one point, you know, the Scooby-Doo-esque view of those darn kids was, well, if those darn kids just could get the movie times, they would be back in the theaters in a heartbeat.
Yep, yep.
And then you gave them the movie times, and it was, oh, maybe they like watching movies on their tablets.
Yeah.
Maybe they like the other things. Maybe we need to compete with that, and we can't just tell ourselves there's an easy fix.
Right. And, of course, you know, we've gone in those 10 years. That's a really good point. In those 10 years, you know, we've gone to movies being produced and shown nearly immediately on streaming services, Amazon Prime. Amazon won, I think, an Academy Award for one of their movies the other year. And I think the recent Martin Scorsese movie, I think it's called The Irishman, produced for Netflix, on Netflix. Those movies, I think, were shown in theaters just for a couple of weeks, maybe, just to qualify for the Academy Awards, and then were immediately available via streaming. So... yeah, it has changed the industry, and I wonder, you know, and I think theaters have changed a lot in the last 10 years, you know, since Netflix and other streaming services, you know, started competing with them. A number of theaters where I live have modified their seating, so it's more stadium seating versus, you know, traditional movie seating, where if you're a real tall guy like you, John, if a tall guy like you is sitting right in front of you, you know, you're kind of blocked from view in a traditional movie theater seating. But I know a friend of mine, 6'7", he's always very considerate, and he kind of crouches down, is uncomfortable for the whole movie when he takes his family to the movies. But and the other one, speaking of streaming, not for its streaming, but Amazon, you know, the Amazon app. We had that. I think we already had the Amazon app on the iPhone, but there's something about the iPad that just made shopping a lot easier. You know, you could see pictures better, and you could read reviews faster because you didn't have to scroll as much. I buy a lot on my iPad. Well, actually, what I do, and you know, I recommend this to other people, is I will put things in my cart from the iPad, and then I'll walk over to a notebook. I mean, sorry, notebook PC or desktop. To go to smile.amazon.com, and that way you can donate to your favorite charity. I think there's a way to do it for my phone, but every time I try to register it for smile.amazon.com, it kind of errors out. So not sure what's going on with that. And also related to that is Comixology. Now, I know you're not a comic book fan, John. At least
but
not the point where you read them.
I actually use the Comixology app and have played around with it. Yeah. Every so often I find a comic I do want to read, so yeah. I do go use Comixology for that.
Well, I am a lifelong fanatic, you know, to a point where I've probably spent far too much money on comic books in my lifetime than I should have. But I stopped reading or buying physical comics because of Comixology. I stopped buying comics at the you know, kind of the comic book store or sundry store years before that, and started just buying collections from Amazon, and that, you know, the collections look like graphic novels. They're kind of big, thick things that collect a whole bunch of issues. But Comixology changed the way I read comics and changed the way I think about other kinds of consumption activities, you know, along with Netflix. The one big, I don't know if I can call it, but one big change that caused a bit of a glitch and maybe saved me some money is when Amazon bought Comixology and refused to pay Apple its, you know, its 30% tithing to sell from within the iPad app. You can still do it on an Android site, by the way. So now you can no longer buy comics directly on the iPad, which slowed down my buying, which is good, saved me money over years. But then eventually I finally got around, again, you know, this subscription thinking we talked about earlier. It was just, I think, last year, maybe 2018, but surely 2019, I finally broke down and bought Comixology Unlimited, which I think is like $6 or $7 a month, and you can read anything that is in the Unlimited package. Not every comic, but many of them. So, real game changer for me. And also, I tried other apps, like I tried iBooks to buy comics, I tried Google Plays, Google Books Reader to buy comics, but the reading experience was simply not as good as Comixology, so didn't quite change the industry from the publishing side, but not from the reading side. I think they're pretty much the dominant player right now, and they've also become a publisher. Another one, you know, here, you know, there's a couple of apps that I think are game changers that I really don't use much, and here's one of them: GarageBand for iPad. You know,
I agree it's a game changer. I have always had a lot of fun with it, and it's fun I wouldn't have had any other way. So it is a game changer in that regard. But yeah, I don't use it as much as I could have used it, but it's fun.
It is. And I think because it's so powerful, it had some weaknesses early on in the number of tracks you could do. But so did the desktop version, for that matter. So, you know, can't really fault it for that. And as the iPad became more popular, it became pretty amazing. Again, I don't use it much. I've probably opened it a couple times a year for doing various things since it's... but I always keep it on my iPad. You know, I never delete it. Because, you know, one day that great, you know, symphony will come to me and I'll jot it down in GarageBand.
That great song idea, you'll be ready to go with it.
That's right. You know, the Todd's First Symphony. Let's see. Oh, here's another one that I have never used. In fact, I didn't even hear of it until I started looking for apps that people thought made a difference. And our past guest panelist, Ricky Lee, recommended it too. And I started looking it up. It's called LumaVision. And apparently it is sort of the video editing app of choice on the iPad. And I did not know that. Because I don't do much in the way of video. I mean, I shoot clips, but I'm not a serious video producer like Ricky and... you know, people use this thing are. So LumaVision, it was news to me, but as I read more about it, this apparently is, you know, the big one.
We're just not what we're supposed to be as
creators.
Podcasters. As podcasters, we're supposed to look at something we don't use and say, well, it must be crap because we didn't use it. So we're just violating that stereotype quite a bit.
Now, one I used to use and I don't anymore, and I'm going to ask you, you know, because how you feel about it, is Amazon's Kindle app. Do you still use it?
I used to. Now, if I can find something, if I have to get something on Kindle, there are ways to remove the DRM for Kindle books that you own. And so I will just do that and read it in the Apple iBooks app.
Oh, interesting.
Because we'll talk more about iBooks coming up, but I find I'd rather just have all of my books as much as possible in one place. And since I have a large collection of ebooks and a large collection of just PDFs and stuff like that, that's where they end up
going. Interesting. So I used to use the Kindle app pretty regularly. Used to enjoy reading regular novels and things on it. But over the years, I pretty much switched to Amazon's other property, Audible, and listen to most fiction and nonfiction works, driving to and from work these days. The one thing I still do put on or buy for the Kindle are reference books, where I have to just sort of sit and stare at something to comprehend it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I know I don't think my wife uses the Kindle app much on her iPad, except when she's traveling, but she has a regular, the Kindle hardware that she's bought several generations of. So in general, the Kindle changed the industry, and in particular, the Kindle app for the iPad, I think, changed the way we read, or for me, used to read.
Yeah, and I still do have a Kindle, but I typically sideload onto my Kindle. I don't buy that many books through Amazon unless they're really the only places or they have the really best price on it.
I see. Speaking of something I used to use a lot and don't, Flipboard. I used to use it every day. Now, this past week when we're putting these lists together, I had to go see if he was still around. It is, by the way. But I don't think it's as popular or well-known as it used to be. But I do think it changed the way we looked at news, the way we looked at news from our social media feeds, Twitter in particular for me. I don't know, John, were you ever a Flipboard user?
I was never a big Flipboard user. I downloaded it and played with it a few times. Yeah. And I definitely got where the appeal came from with it, but I never really got into it that much. In fact, if you had not checked, I would have had to check to see if they were even still around.
Yeah, and they are, as I said. Mm-hmm. But I think they really did change. They created an intersection between reading reference and Twitter, which is short form, right? So Twitter, your friends and people you follow, even if you don't know them, provided references for you. But they're, short. Back then it was 140 characters. And Flipboard would just take it and provide you with at least a thumbnail of it, so you begin reading and then you open it up. It was a pretty decent reading experience too. I might reinstall it just to see what it's like these days. Although I think in some respects Reddit has replaced that, and Dig, and all those kind of other portals, if you will, or aggregators of news and other kinds of information. Okay. Now, I don't know if you agree with me on this one either, John, but Gmail for iPad. And the reason I say that is because, on the iPhone, Gmail, all the mail apps, basically they showed you a list of subject lines and maybe a little blurb and date and thing. But then you'd open up the email and you'd lose your place in your email queue and your subject lines, and you forget what you want to read next until you close it and go back. With Gmail for iPad, and I think Apple's own email app, it was more like a desktop experience again, where you could see your subject lists, all the time and have enough space on the screen to read stuff. I can't say I use mail heavily on my iPad, except for work, and there I'm using Outlook for the web, of all things, which is not bad, actually. But it's not a game changer, I think, the way Gmail and I'll add Apple's own email for the app for the iPad. Are you a heavy email user on iPad?
I am, but it's odd for me. Even though I have Gmail installed and my personal email goes through Gmail, I tend to use the Microsoft Outlook app.
Interesting.
Extensively. I said, I'm the only person on the planet that Focused Inbox works for.
Yeah.
I embrace that, but one of the things I think Gmail for the iPad did as an app that actually changed the world was Google came in and said, Apple, we're not going to make our app look anything like your apps. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got a design language. We've got a design language. We're going to take our Android design language and, you know, look and bring it over to iOS. And they did. They did it really. It was a very slow app to begin with because it had to look like that. And I think that was their biggest problem. Now the Gmail app is a little quicker. The only thing that makes me annoyed with the Gmail app is that I cannot accept two-factor authentication prompts through the native iOS accept or reject. You know, all you get is dismiss. And so that means my phone and my iPad and my watch, when I get a, is this you signing in to whatever, it just says dismiss and I have to open the app. Whereas, you know, Microsoft's authenticator, Apple's two-factor, Yahoo's two-factor, as I've mentioned before, they can all be dismissed from just the notification. So that's one thing I really wish that Google would get working, because I, at this point, I have to think it's just them being stubborn, going, you know what, we need people to be in the app. We can't expose the approve or deny button outside of that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, Google has had, since its launch of Google Gmail for iPad, has had its issues with Gmail or mail apps. You might remember Inbox, which some of our friends were really fans of. I think, in fact, weren't you a fan of Inbox? Or
I had played with it here and there. I wasn't a huge fan of it.
I think Frank McPherson.
More than a week.
Yeah, I think Frank McPherson was a huge fan of it. We'll check with Frank to see if that's true and confirm or deny that. So the next up is related, since you mentioned Outlook for the web, and that's Microsoft Office 365. Especially, you know, for the web stuff, and especially because when the iPad, at least before the iPad became a behemoth, the Pros became a behemoth, and it was less than 10-inch screens, it didn't count against any of your licenses.
And I still, you know, my goal in life, I tell people, is to replace specialty apps with things like Excel, because I think Excel can do a lot of the things that we have one-off apps for. So I definitely think the Office Suite is one of them. I know it's one of my most used apps on iPad, and I think is one of my favorites. And it was a definite game changer. I remember 4 years ago, before it became widely known that Office was on the iPad, I had someone who saw that I was using an iPad in a room full of Surfaces look at me and go, oh, you use an iPad, so I guess you don't want to actually get work done. And
wow,
I said,
I can bring up
Word on here just like you can.
Yeah.
And showed it to the person, and they were a little bit shocked. They had remembered how it was 10 years ago with Office apps on iPad.
Yeah. Actually, I don't remember Office apps being available that long ago, but I'll take your word for it.
They were, you know, they were very poorly available, if they were available at all.
And there were sort of work-alikes like Polaris Office and products like that, which weren't bad, but, you know, they weren't 100% compatible either.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and the other thing I think is not just influential for the iPad, but it was a sea change for Microsoft to make truly functional versions of their Office components available on not just a mobile platform, but a non-Microsoft platform. In fact, I think it was introduced when Windows Mobile was still around. It was far better than Office on the Windows Mobile platform. Just far better. Okay. And the last most influential app, really it's a category. I was going to just say Evernote, but I know that several of our friends, including Chris Spera and I think Frank McPherson, both noted OneNote. And so I'm going to make note-taking apps in general. So I'm going to lump Evernote, OneNote, and Notability, which is the iPad app I normally use to take notes when I'm not using a notebook computer, which is often these days.
Mm-hmm.
I think that really changed the way at least I take notes. Evernote first, because it's sort of, you know, what everything falls out from. Even the OneNote, I guess, is a contemporary. I was never a OneNote fan. So for me, Evernote was a thing. And then after Evernote started going downhill, Notability is the app I use these days, along with Google Keep, which I'll talk about later, but note-taking apps in general.
Yeah, anything that really lets you take notes, I think, was a game changer, that you could actually truly take notes on the iPad. Because before that, you were sort of
Oh, bless you.
You were sort of limited to just pounding out a little text note here and there before you could actually start writing or using or sketching or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so that's our list. It's certainly, I'll say it's incomplete. There's probably things on there that should be there that aren't. We don't have any games on here, for example. And I'd be willing to, I have games in my personal ones. Maybe we can talk about those later and whether they should be considered most influential. But first, let's go to where John and I actually have a disagreement. So John and I don't disagree a lot on stuff, but apparently we do have one big disagreement. Well, we'll get to that. The first one is app types that seemed like they were a good idea but weren't. And the first one that comes to mind is magazine apps. I remember I bought Time Magazine. Let me see how I phrase this. I didn't buy the app. I bought the magazine, which had an app shell around it, I guess. So you had to buy the magazines, I think, by issue. So each issue was a separate app or something like that, separate install. It seemed like a good idea, but essentially it was a replica of the magazine page. And they tried to do things like have animation and some other features, but it just never flew. I mean, and there were a bunch of other ones. I think Life Magazine, which at that point was not published, but they were doing like special issues of photos and things, tried it. And just, I don't know, it didn't work for me. I think some websites tried it too, some of the bigger tech websites, for example. Do you miss them, John?
I don't really miss them too much. I mean, I used Xenio for a long time, and I tried doing magazines, and now I read them through Apple News Plus.
That's right.
That gets me exactly what I want when I want it, so that's what I go with.
Yeah. And I'm not an Apple News Plus subscriber, although I consume a lot of news on my iPad. I don't know. Maybe I'll think about it. Okay, here we go. Second screen dedicated apps. I don't know if you remember these, John, but Disney, I think, pioneered that idea. In fact, I think they called it second screen. So the idea was you're watching a Disney classic like Bambi or Snow White or something, and the second screen would provide play-by-play information or trivia or, basically background info. The kind of things that on DVDs or Blu-rays you would, watch as extra content. Or really what we ended up doing without special apps and just looking stuff up while we're watching stuff on television. I downloaded the Avatar Seconds, and Universal had a different name for it, but I downloaded the Avatar Second Screen app and I think maybe the Bambi or Snow White. And it was interesting, but I'm not sure it really added anything and I kind of dropped it after that. But it seemed like a good idea at the time. I was pretty interested in it. This was, as a superhero movie started getting popular, I thought, oh, this would be very cool if they did something with those movies. But nothing ever happened with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did like that idea. It was also similar to what Netflix did with the X-ray view when you would tap and all of a sudden there would be things that you could further tap on or
I think it's
about.
Amazon Prime, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, Amazon Prime or Netflix, whichever one did that. So I just think people, when they're watching something, if they want to know more, they'll pull out their phone and look on their own. But I don't think they're going to natively do that.
You don't need a special app. Yeah. Okay, here's one where John and I disagree. I really want to hear what John has to say. And he's already kind of hinted at it. And Apple iBooks, which came after the Amazon Kindle app, and iBooks Creator, which lets you create your own content, which I thought was the more interesting part, really. Mm-hmm. I bought a couple of Apple special books. I think I bought like a Beatles guitar songbook, which not only had the sheet music and history of the song, but also had snippets so you could hear how that a portion of the song was supposed to be played, specifically on guitar. So I thought that was really interesting, and I'm not sure I should try to download it still to see if it's still downloadable to iBooks. And I think I bought one or two graphic novels and regular novels and maybe a reference book to try it out. And then I just lost interest. I even tried to create some content using iBook Creator just to see what it was like. And I thought it would revolutionize textbook creation things, but it didn't. But I know you use it heavily based on what you said earlier, John.
Well, and it goes with what platform you like and what platform you're locked into. So for textbooks, that's a good example. Apple was really hoping people would lock into their platform, and mm-hmm. it turned out there were already proprietary platforms for textbooks that got more traction, and Apple's still fighting in that space. You know, I liked Apple Books. I liked that they synced up through iCloud so that if I was dropping my own stuff in, it would appear on other devices. Mm-hmm. So I went with that, and I really do enjoy the enhanced ebooks. So I have the Harry Potter collection and the Game of Thrones collection in the enhanced format, and those are kind of nice because every so often you get animations, you get behind the scenes footnotes that you don't normally get, you get snippets of the audiobooks. So I do enjoy that when I'm reading those kind of epic series of novels. But I think it's just six of one, half dozen of another. If you stuck in the Amazon ecosystem and you liked Kindle, then you stayed there. If you jumped over and tried iBooks and you liked it, then you stayed there. I think it's – I can see where you're coming from, but I also think that I enjoy it the way I do too.
Yeah, yeah. And as an academic, John, have you ever created content using the iBook Creator?
I've used the iBook Creator a little bit because I've put together the two self-published novels I have that are on iBooks. I use the iBook Creator for. It's not great, but it's not horrible.
Yeah.
It does need work. It's clear that Apple has not put a lot of effort into it because not a lot of people are using it.
Yeah. And, that's an interesting market that I forgot about, and that's a self-published market, which, it's common for video people to put stuff on YouTube, but you really don't think about people self-publishing books. And I guess it does make it pretty easy. I think you can do it in the mm-hmm. Kindle too, but I'm not sure I read any self-published books. The only exception would be, and I read it after it was published, was The Martian. I think Andy mm-hmm. Weir's book started off as a self-published book and then became actually published and a mega hit. The other one is just a perennial, and this is from the beginning of personal computing, is recipe apps. Every decade, every year since the introduction of the TRS-80 Model 1 and the Apple II, and I guess some of the CPM based x86 systems in the 1970s, people have always said recipes are what you should be using your computer for, and I've downloaded and tried a couple, and I never use them for more than two or three uses. I don't know. It just seems like a good idea. Always seems like a good idea. Every year it seems like a good idea. And I never end up using them.
Well, I think that with recipe apps, you need to have an actual use scenario for them.
Yeah.
So the recipe app that I do use uh-huh. is AnyList. But as you've probably guessed from the title, AnyList is not a recipe app.
Right.
It's a shopping list app.
Right.
And the reason I like it is because I can import my recipes into it, and then with one tap, add uh-huh. those items to my shopping list.
Ah, that is
and
nice.
And then when I'm at the store, it'll tell me, okay, you're buying this, and it'll even tell me what recipe I'm buying mm-hmm. it for. And that I find that very useful.
And does it?
Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask if AnyList, does it do kind of a geofencing so it knows what store you're at or anything like that?
It doesn't, but it might support it. I've just never set it up. Okay. I've been using it for about 5-6 years, so I'm sure there's features in it that I've never played cool. with. It'll also do meal planning, which I don't use that often, and a few other interesting things. So I think you need to have a reason to use a recipe database.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I think for some people, they'll probably vehemently disagree with me on this one because they'll say, well, I use one every day, and they're probably great cooks and try all kinds of things, but any case. Okay, now to what I'm really interested in is because I want to hear what John has to say. So I'll rip through mine real quick because I've talked about some of them already. And the first one is Comixology. Mentioned that earlier. Still use it today. Been using 10 years. Finally subscribed to Comixology Unlimited. Really enjoying it. Think I'm getting my money's worth. Here's one that's no longer around that I'm going to try to try not to sob. Civilization Revolution, it's no longer compatible with the 64, it's a 32-bit app, so it's not compatible with the 64-bit versions of today's iOS, so I can't run it on any iPad that I've upgraded, which is all of them except one iPad Mini 4, where I can still play it if I really want to. Great game, yes, I bought Civilization 2, yes, I bought Civilization 6, no, I don't like them. Plants vs. Zombies, HD, high definition. You might, I don't know, John, if you recall, but when iPad apps are new, the iPhone and iPad apps are sometimes differentiated. They're actually two versions. So there was Plants vs. Zombies for the iPhone, and there was Plants vs. Zombies HD for the larger screen iPad. And boy, I like Plants vs. Zombies on the small iPhone, but it is a whole different experience on a larger screen. It's a great casual game. If you're a serious gamer, you'll probably poo-poo it, but I thought it was a great casual game, and it changed the way I looked at games. Both It and Civilization Revolution, those two games, changed the way I looked at games on the iPad and mobile devices in general. I know you're a gamer, John, so I don't know if you do casual games like Plants vs. Zombies and Civilization Revolution.
Yeah, and I've played Plants vs. Zombies and have enjoyed it. So I will note that I do think that casual gaming is where the iPad really
excels. Now, that said, again, a little bit of a sidetrack. Have you subscribed to Apple Arcade? I have not.
No, I have not.
Yeah, I'm a casual gamer versus a serious casual gamer, I guess. Next one that is my personal favorite that I've already mentioned is Google Keep. As Evernote sinks into the sunset, in my opinion, I've been switching to Google Keep. I was trying, what was it called? I would have to go look on my phone if I have it. I've been trying to use Notion. And it's not bad. It's not bad. It's not as clean as Evernote. But Google Keep is really clean. And at work, I've been using OneNote because we're a Microsoft, Office 365 shop. But that's been happening. And finally, an app I actually haven't used in a couple months because I've been using, what am I using? Infinite Painter lately. But for my daily doodles project, where I do a little quick little doodle every night, Procreate was what really got me started. It's a great tool. They just had a major upgrade a few months ago. I switched to Infinite Painter, not because Procreate's bad, but I just wanted to try different tools to see if different painting tools, and I've tried about half a dozen now, could do something better than Procreate. And it does do a few things better than Procreate. So Procreate gets my tap as a personal fave for my doodling. But Infinite Painter and Taiyasui? It's not Japanese, by the way. It's French. Mm-hmm. Taiyasui, what is it called? Sketchbook Pro is another one that I would recommend. So those three. I tried some others, but I don't recommend them. Maybe ZenBrush, but that's very specialized. Okay, now I want to hear what John has to say. His list is like completely different.
Yeah, so a few things. NoteShelf and iAnnotate are the two apps that I've used the most over the last 10 years to eliminate paper in my life. iAnnotate was one of the first PDF readers, editors, all of that. Now a lot of that functionality is built into things like the OneNote, the OneDrive app and things like that. But I still use iAnnotate just because I've used to using iAnnotate. NoteShelf I like because I can load custom notebook papers into it, so I can use it actually as a form filler out if I need to. So those are the two. That was sort of the biggest draw for iPad for me, was that it let me eliminate a lot of paper. And it was because I could use those to either read or write notes and ebooks and such on the go.
And it's a one-time charge, $10?
Yep, both of them are one-time apps.
Yeah, so $10 for the iPad or iPhone also, I guess. 4.5 stars, or 4.3 stars with over 1,000 ratings. So that's pretty good. I think I have NoteShelf that I got for free on my Chromebook. It's one of the freebies that they gave away, but I have not tried it on any other platform. I got to try this. So you use this in place of Evernote or along with Evernote and other note-taking apps?
Along with,
okay.
Mostly for just purely whenever I need to handwrite out notes.
Okay. And does it do handwriting recognition?
I don't believe it does. Handwriting recognition has never worked well for me, so I've never tried to play with it.
Me too. Okay. And I'm just trying to figure out, looking at the samples, if these people have really nice handwriting or is that like a handwriting-looking font? But
could be either.
I will try it. It's worth $10, I think, to try it. And does it have a web version also, or is it purely on Mac and iOS?
Purely Mac and iOS.
Okay.
And then gaming, so you talked a little bit about gaming. My gaming list was a little different. So Grand Theft Auto 3, Grand Theft Auto Vice City, some of the classic Grand Theft Auto games. And then some turn-by-turn based games like Ticket to Ride and Carcassonne. You can play those with friends on iOS so that you can actually – and actually the Ticket to Ride implementation is really nice. So it'll actually work across platform. So if you have friends on Android tablets or, you know, Android phones, they can play along as well. And then individual games, the three that I've really gotten into over the last 2-3 years, Mini Metro, which is kind of a subway simulator where you get to build stations and demand and all that. And then the ironic Plague Inc. and Rebel Inc., which I saw someone say that that was January 2020. Rebel Inc. started us off, and then Plague Inc. took over midway through. And, of course, the joke there being that they're by the same game design studio. Fortunately, the world sort of emulated Rebel Inc. for the first 15 days of January, and now Plague Inc., unfortunately. And that kind of is all my gaming. I used to play some of the other apps that we talked about last week. We talked about Battleship and Tetris and the original Monopoly, Risk, those sorts of games I really like on the iPad. But right now, it's mostly Ticket to Ride and Carcassonne if I'm playing iPad apps with friends.
And I think some of those EA apps, Electronic Art games, are no longer available. Because I think I bought a few things like Scrabble and things like that, you know, before Word for Friends became really popular. And I don't think I can download them anymore. There's a bunch of games I really enjoyed that I can't download anymore, which is a shame. Or run if I could download them.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, John.
We mentioned Microsoft Office. Yep. I also throw the Google Drive apps in there.
Yep.
I'm glad to have both of those. And then I have this sort of collection of apps that allow me to do very niche desktop type things, things that you might have thought I will never be able to get away from the desktop for those things. So Scrivener, which I use for a lot of my writing, it syncs with the Mac version. It syncs through Dropbox, works very well to when you're writing, you know, fiction usually, although you can write anything with it. And then just very quickly, things like Working Copy is an app for managing Git repos. If you had told me I could do version control management and such, I would have scoffed at that on the iPad 10 years ago. CryptoDisks is good for opening TrueCrypt and VeraCrypt containers. So if you use those to secure your data on flash drives or other places that you have data at rest that you want encrypted, there's a app for that on iOS, CryptoDisks, that lets you open those and work with them. And there's SSH Tunnel, which did get a little bit limited with iOS 13 because of the changes that Apple made to multitasking, although it still works. And Screens, which is a VNC screen app that lets you connect up. And I use that quite a bit at home to connect to virtual machines or my laptop in the other room. And many times, you know, if I need something on my laptop and it's just a quick thing, I can use Screens, pop over to that, control it off the iPad, and not have to even go get the MacBook.
So, John, you may find this amusing, and you probably never ran into it, but decades ago, not years ago, decades ago, before we had GUI interfaces on our operating systems, with exception, I guess, of Mac OS, whatever it was back then, in the 1980s and 1990s, there is a Unix application utility called Screen, plural. And what it did is it could save your session into a cached file in your profile, in your Unix login profile. You could log out of one system, log into another terminal, right? This is before we had notebooks and things that could really do anything useful. Log into another terminal in some other building and room and restart where you left off. You know, which is kind of amazing back then. But anyway, since you mentioned Screens, I'll mention Screen. This is text-based, of course, and it was kind of a fun. Well, actually, it was really useful, not just fun. It was a really useful way to get around. You know, I got to check out this stuff. I have never heard of Working Copy, so you know, I did not know it was available for Git. And I heard about, I think you told me about CryptoDisks, but I haven't used. I used to use TrueCrypt a lot to secure data, and I probably should again. And really, I guess it's called VeraCrypt now, right? So TrueCrypt is, as a name, brand name is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so that's our trip down memory lane. Hope our fives of listeners enjoyed it. I know John and I enjoyed putting our list together.
Yeah, it was interesting to think about how over 10 years this device that at one time I left in a closet for 2 or 3 months, now I take with me pretty much everywhere I go.
Yep, same here. I carry it every time I leave the house. I have an iPad mini with me. And if I don't, it's probably because I somehow forgot it, and I can't remember the last time that happened. And in case, MobiViews Podcast 316, we kind of reviewed our personal memories of the history of the iPad over the last decade. It's been, you know, I just read some article, I think it was in Forbes or someplace, how the iPad is a failure. Oh, no, it wasn't Forbes. Forbes mentioned it, but I think it was during Fireball, which is, you know, generally speaking, a very pro Apple site. So there was I found it a little strange that John Gruber considered the iPad, I think it was John Gruber, that considers the iPad a failure. But, you know, in the sense I didn't live up to some of the promises that Steve Jobs implied or said back in 2010 when he announced it. But I think it has actually surpassed some of the things he said. And like all good technology, all great technology, it may not have served the purpose that its creator intended, in this case Steve Jobs and his team, but it found other purposes that they probably didn't envision 10 years ago. At least, I don't think they envisioned. They didn't mention it.
I definitely think that if Steve Jobs were here today, he would have not approved of the way the iPad went. I think in his mind, it should have stayed a content creation tool, or not a content consumption tool, not a creation tool.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, was probably his long-term goal, to make sure that MacBooks were not cannibalized by the iPad.
Yeah.
So I don't see, for example, the changes in iOS 13 that allow you to use a mouse with the iPad through accessibility. I don't see that ever being something he would have allowed. Perhaps the whole iPad Pro line wouldn't even have been something that he would have been going for.
Yeah.
So it is interesting to see how a product, I do believe a successful product, can do things differently than how their creator intended them to, and perhaps just as well, if not better.
Yeah, and I think similarly, the Apple Pencil, you know,
he
was vehement in his Apple iPad announcement the iPhone announcement too. You don't need a stylus, right? And he's still right. You don't need a stylus to use an iPad, but boy, with an Apple Pencil, it is a whole different animal. And I am very grateful that it is. Okay. Again, Apple Podcast, MobiViews Podcast 316, and we are going to sign off for this one. Talk to you later.